So first, a little bit about agriculture in Washington. Not a lot of people realize what a major industry it is. It's the number one employer in the state, and it produces $6.4 billion of revenue annually. So that is huge. We're second only to the state of California in terms of crop diversity. So I don't think oftentimes we find people aren't aware of the significance of this industry in Washington State. For every $1 billion worth of revenue in the fruit industry, it generates 23,000 jobs, and every dollar spent on crop production generates an additional $2.30 of economic activity. The reason I wanted to include that slide is just so to give you a sense for, it's not just the direct revenue that's generated within the industry, but there's a real multiplier effect. And for those of you who may be from small towns, you'll see that from the weed and feed store down the street to those who sell, you know, the tractors and equipment and so forth. So there really is a very significant multiplier effect that impacts our economy. I want to, in exploring a little more about farm workers in Washington State, I'm going to give you just a very small taste of a major study that was just completed. You'll see the source at the top there. That's the Washington State Farm Worker Housing Trust. This is an organization that Senator Patty Murray started a few years ago. It includes three primary groups on its board of directors. It's people from the grower, the ag industry and growers, the housing community, and farm worker advocates. And those are three different constituencies that have not always got along historically in Washington State, particularly the ag industry representatives and farm worker advocates. There's a lot of issues there which we could talk about, including unionizing efforts and so forth that can cause conflict or mistrust between the groups. But the Washington State Farm Worker Housing Trust has kind of led the way in trying to get those groups to the table and talking with one another and agreeing on some common principles to try to improve farm worker housing in the state. So they just did a groundbreaking study in 06. It was throughout the calendar year of 06, and it was just published recently. And so I'm going to refer to it for several slides here for some of the data. But you'll see here 187,000 farm workers in the state of Washington. That's a huge number. And in addition to that, there are 102,000 dependent family members. I think often when people hear those kind of raw figures, they're amazed at the number of people who are actively employed in agriculture. If you look up the Washington State Farm Worker Housing Trust on the website, you can download this entire report, and it's really extensive. And unfortunately, I'm just going to focus on some key elements, but there's a lot more data here that I'd encourage any and all of you to check out if you'd like. But I will cover a few of the major findings. Here you see those working in Washington State Ag. Almost 60% have been doing so for more than 5 years, and 27% for more than 10. So these are people and households that have been in our communities often for many, many years. And it's not strictly a migrant population. There's a lot of what we refer to as settled out farm workers who are full-time, year-round members of the community, just like you and I are. One of the things I'd like to draw your attention to in this particular slide is that point on the bottom. 40% of the surveyed farm workers are uncertain how long they'll continue to work in agriculture in Washington. It's very hard work. It's low pay. It's seasonal in nature. And so there are a lot of good reasons why they're looking for better opportunities. That's one component of it. Another component is from the employer perspective. When they see a figure like this, it makes them very concerned. you know, if you work somewhere or your parents are a business owner, and if you think about 40% of your workforce, they're not so sure they want to keep going doing what they're doing. That's something that's very concerning. And so again, when you look at it from that industry perspective, it's something people want to do something about. So housing is one of the things that can be done to help not only provide more appropriate housing for the farm workers themselves, but it's a great recruitment and retention tool for employers. And as you see here in this top bullet, 91% of respondents said more or better housing would encourage them to continue working in agriculture. So that's a significant finding, that housing does play a real role in those who are working in farm work. And the reason is because historically they've had very poor housing conditions and really struggled with unaffordable rents and substandard conditions and doubling up. So it's not been a good situation. A few additional findings. I'll let you, I know you all can read, or at least most of you can. Theo in the front is learning reading very quickly. But so he and I can cover these in more detail later. Without just reading them all to you, these are a lot of interesting findings as well that are demographics and family composition. The key thing I wanted to draw your attention to is the 70% local and 30% non-local. Basically, that in more layman's terms is year-round, people who live in the area year-round versus those who migrate. And so, as you can see, the vast majority are year-round residents in communities. And in fact, our office, when we're beginning to do a housing development, we'll do market research, which will oftentimes include surveys of local farm workers. And what we find routinely is that the farm worker population, when they have the opportunity to settle out of the migrant stream and no longer migrate for work, they want to do that. You know, they don't choose the migrant lifestyle out of preference. It's out of necessity. And when they have other opportunities, they're quick to want to take those. Income is another major finding of the study. The average household income of the farm workers surveyed, this was for the year 2006 was the survey time, $17,596. That's well below the federal poverty rate, wage. And I don't think that's often for a family of four. So that's a very low income. And again, as we focus on affordable housing as a major, priority of our organization, we have to look at things like, well, if that's the reality of the incomes of a farm worker household, what is rent that is, reasonable? And if you use that figure of $17,500, an affordable rent is about $430 a month. And that can be very hard to come by. In some areas, because the market rents far exceed that. In a lot of rural areas, it's because there's just no inventory. You know, there's not a lot of housing development going on in a lot of rural communities. So there's literally no place to rent, even if they were willing and able to pay whatever the market might be. So a little about ORF and what we do. We are a private nonprofit. Despite our name, we sound a little like the government, and that's often a question I get. Well, aren't you guys a government? And the answer is no, we're not. We were part of a larger nonprofit back in the 70s when ORF was getting started, and that's how it got the name Office Of. And over the course of time, they've kept the name or I should say we've kept the name. And believe it or not, within the affordable housing industry, it's a fairly recognized name, ORF. So There's another little tidbit you probably didn't know before tonight. In addition to the, well, let me talk briefly or quickly about our mission. Our mission is to increase the production of affordable farmworker housing, plain and simple. A second part of our mission is to establish policies and programs that provide new resources for rural affordable housing. So we want to try and engage on the policy side of things, too, so that there are adequate, typically financial resources, but sometimes land use resources and so forth, too, that can allow affordable housing to occur. Since we were established in 79, ORF has developed a little over 1,100 units serving more than 5,500 people around the state. And that's an accomplishment we're very proud of. It's a lot of work, a lot of, as Michael briefly alluded to, just one development. If everything is going real well, will take probably 3 or 4 years to accomplish. If it's not going well, 5, 6, 7. When I was at Eastern, back in Philadelphia, I was taking an economic development course, and a professor of mine there said, when you're thinking about community development and community change, you should think in 5-year increments. If you're thinking of less than that, it's probably not going to happen. And that was, at the time, pretty discouraging to me. I thought, 5 years? Who's got that kind of time? But I've learned that to be the case, and I'm shocked that it's almost been 20 years since I've been at Whitworth, which is just shows you how quickly time goes. One of the things I want to emphasize too at ORF with our board of directors, while we have a real we engage with the agricultural industry and want to be close partners with them, a lot of where we're coming from is really oriented toward the farm worker families themselves. Our priority is quality housing and affordable housing so that those families can have better opportunities in their communities where they have more disposable income and a secure, healthy place to live every night. And that's our emphasis. I want to spend a little time talking about some of the major challenges that we face in trying to develop farmworker housing. I'm not going to go into each of these in detail, but I did want to give you just a sense of some of the major challenges. And as I think about the connection with Whitworth and my experience and the education of the mind and heart, I mean, those themes really do resonate throughout this. So the three major challenges we often face are the financing of the housing because of the incomes that we were just talking about and how to make them affordable. Finding suitable land, which in rural areas across the state is often a real challenge. And then the third is opposition, or the phrase, not in my backyard. Even when there's, you know, you see the ag industry is huge and it's the major economic engine of a lot of small communities. And there's a lot of agreement that that's true. But even with that being the case, there can still be a surprising amount of resistance toward developing farmworker housing, which, there is directly connected to their economy. That element is the one I'll spend a little more time on today. One of the things, another kind of as we start to get into why we do housing and why ORF is involved, you know, a comment that I often hear at some community meetings, particularly from folks who are typically a little more conservative on the political spectrum, they say, well, what about the private sector? You know, isn't the private sector supposed to be providing housing? If we just, you know, unleash the private sector, aren't they going to take care of these problems? And I can't help but think, you know, especially given what's happening in the stock market these days, that maybe there's a reason they had a leash on in the first place, and that was supposed to be a joke. Yeah. So, but there's a point to it too, and that is the private sector is not able to really achieve the low incomes that are, or the low rents that are affordable to the families that we're trying to target. And they, the fact is, you know, they can do market rate developments and make more money, and there's no harm or problem in doing that. It just doesn't serve the population that we're attempting to serve. So there was a study done by the Housing Alliance of Pennsylvania in 2004. Now, this is the part where I'm going to go into a little more on opposition and why it arises and what we can do about it. And I'm going to just read this quote really quickly. Community opposition reflects neighbors' concerns that their lives will change for the worse. Sometimes these concerns are concrete and rational, focused on measurable impacts on a neighborhood. More frequently, they're based on stereotype and anxiety about the new residents or the units in which they will live. I thought this was really an exceptional brief summary. You know, a lot of times we see resistance happening or opposition, but we want to get to, well, why is it happening? And maybe if we understand why it's happening, that'll give us more tools and ability to address it. So not in my backyard is the acronym for, or NIMBY's that acronym, but before we go on, I want to give a quick quiz. I don't think we use pop quizzes nearly enough, so can anybody, so that's NIMBY. Does anybody know what BANANA stands for? If you, and some of you may have heard this before, but so nobody, anybody on BANANA? Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. That's for the real hardcore folks who don't want any change. LULU, anybody on LULU? LULU is locally unwanted land use. And I've heard that one in the context of a number of Walmarts and some of the smaller communities. NOPE is one that what I was just told about recently, which is not on planet Earth. And with the election season, I've also heard NIMTU, which is not in my term of office for the political types. So anyway, those are just some kind of funny things we like to toss around the office. But you know, one of the, I mean, back to what, as we are, again, you know, assessing a market and going to a community that we want to work in and provide housing, we have a phrase we like to kick around, which is, everyone loves us until we pick a site. And that's surprisingly true on a very regular basis. Yes, we need farm worker housing. Yes, ag is a major part of our industry. There? Are you crazy? How about over there? And that really gets at the heart of a lot of the opposition that we try to address. The picture here is in Benton City. Do any of you know where Benton City is, down by the Tri-Cities? We were in a big, we were working on a development there where we were moving ahead. We had land that was zoned for multifamily housing, which is what we wanted to build. And the city council was supportive. In fact, they were going to help finance part of it. And some opposition came up and really started getting kind of heated. And so the city council said, well, we think we should hold a hearing about what you guys are wanting to do. And our response was, well, okay, that's fine. We'll do, actually, there's a technical point here. We didn't want to do a hearing. We said, we'll do a public meeting, but a hearing implies that there's a decision to be made. And when you're building multifamily housing in a multifamily zone, that's an allowed development. So we didn't want to give the impression that we're seeking the community's approval to build this when that's really not the case. But we do want to have a community meeting to tell people what we're doing and why we think it's appropriate. A thing I failed to mention earlier is ORF does not own and manage the housing ourselves. We always work in partnership with a local group who does. So while I'm talking a lot about opposition and resistance, there's always local support too. So when we have these community meetings, we also have a lot of people who are there in favor, who will ultimately own and manage these developments. So fortunately, it's not it's not just this wave of resistance from local communities without any support. But just back to this Benton City example, Unfortunately, one of the things I've learned in my experience at while working at ORF is discrimination is still alive and well in the state of Washington. There was a community meeting that, again, in Benton City, where we had to go move it from City Hall, which is a tenth of the size of this room, to the gymnasium because there were 100 people there. And in this case, there was probably about 80 who were, the pitchfork carriers and really not happy about this, and maybe 20 who were supportive. Well, one of the things we always try to do is encourage people, especially the council in this case, to go look at some of our other developments. This is not a mystery here of what we're doing, so go check them out. We're proud of the work we've done, and take a look and tell us what you think. So I had made that offer to this city council a number of times, and so we got into this meeting, and one of the council members, and this was recorded, and there was a video camera and all this stuff. One of the council members said, "Well, Marty keeps telling us to go check up on this stuff," and so I decided to. I went over to Mattawa and I went up to Toppenish, and it's pretty apparent to me that these people are breeding like rabbits at this place, and I was shocked. My jaw dropped, and I thought, this guy is an elected official, and he's in a recorded public meeting saying this stuff. It was unbelievable. And the reaction was of the majority of the crowd was, "Yeah, what about that?" It's like, what? It was like hard to comprehend. So anyway, I'm kind of going off on this one a little more than I meant to, but this was really an interesting case because based on that statement and some other statements, they were really derailing our development, which had financing. We were ready to go, but they were not willing to issue building permits, and they had no basis for holding it up, again, because of those land use things I'd mentioned earlier. And so we filed a fair housing complaint, and I'll get to that a little bit later, through Department of Housing and Urban Development. Well, they thought the case had merit, so they forwarded it to the Department of Justice, and we were like, all right. So our office had a couple lawyers from D.C. calling us from the Department of Justice. Now, what happened at this council meeting? And so we said, well, here, you don't have to listen to us. Listen to the tape. And so next thing you know, these guys flew out to Benton City from Washington, D.C., and were interviewing the mayor and the city council. And so it was pretty exciting, to have these D.C. Department of Justice lawyers, excuse me, shaking things up in Benton City. And it was not long after that that they decided to process our building permits. What a surprise. So that felt like a real good victory. But it was hard fought and took a lot of time was very costly, frankly, because as some of you may know, that in the construction world, time really is money, and the more you're delayed, the higher the cost gets. So these delay tactics really do pose a significant risk to our ability to develop farmworker housing. So again, back to that quote from the Housing Alliance of Pennsylvania. In summary, the way I very briefly summarized it here, and this is just kind of human reaction. This is not small town reaction, or this is really, I think we all have some of this. But change often, we respond to it with fear, and we respond to fear with opposition. That's not uncommon, and no one's to be blamed for that. It's just something we need to understand. And again, it's this Housing Alliance study that I'm citing a lot of this stuff from. But they categorize this type of opposition into two things, fact-based opposition and fear-based opposition. So first I'd like to talk about some commonly cited fact-based opposition. And the quote you see there is a quote from a different development, more recent, and it's called Vista del Rio, which was in Douglas County. I guess what I should also say is the good news is probably 75-80% of our developments experience some resistance, but, you know, we're able to overcome that and move on to development. That's probably more like 80 or 85. It's the very small minority that really hit major opposition where you have to do a fair housing complaint or take legal actions. That's not the way we want to develop. It's not the community we want to build, but it is something that we feel strongly about when the resistance and the opposition is based on something that like discrimination, that our organization feels like we need to be able to confront that too. Because we kind of take the tact of if we don't, who's going to? So fortunately, that's the minority of cases, but it does happen. So the quote you see in the box is another concerned citizen in Douglas County who said, "Too much housing in one location for the school district." Well, that's a potentially legitimate fear, as are the impact on traffic and the environmental impact of a new development. Those are what we consider basically fact-based kind of concerns. Fortunately, there are tools to combat those. Provide copies of relevant studies. We, as a course of our development work, we contact the school district and say, "Hey, here's what we're doing. We're going to build, you know, we want to build this many units. It's going to serve this type of household, and they typically have these kids." Well, the thing that schools readily acknowledge is these are families already in their community, by and large, and these are kids that are already in their schools. We're just talking about better housing and more affordable housing. So we get a letter from the school saying, "Yes, we've considered the impact, and it's negligible." So you share that with the community, and that goes a long way. Same with you can do traffic studies, environmental reports. We do those on a very regular basis to demonstrate we are being good stewards of the environment. You can also get testimony from realtors. Another thing we like to do is demonstrate, you know, once the units are built and operational, that, hey, we've got a good solid budget here to maintain them, to manage them well. We're not going to be an absentee landlord who, you know, kind of just soaks out as much money as you can and then walks away. We're here. We're available. If you have concerns, talk to us. So that typically goes a long way. The other is the fear-based opposition, and this was another quote from, our work in Douglas County. Actually, there was a publication that, or it was a piece of paper that someone had copied, multiple copies of, and just set it next to the sign-in sheet of a public meeting that we were having. And it was, and one of the statements was, "Aesthetically displeasing now, wait until it's full with two families in each unit, 3 to 4 cars in each unit." Well, that's a fear-based statement, because our management plans and requirement and the lease requirements are there may not be two families per unit. There may only be one family per unit. There are only two spaces per parking spaces per unit. You know, so those are things that people worry about, but in fact aren't accurate. A couple others include increased crime, decreased property values, and again, some of the quotes we heard, development will bring different, quote-unquote, people. They'll take over our basketball courts, they'll park their cars on the lawns, and they'll not speak English. You know, these are, again, those are in quotations because they that's what was said. And, you know, it's hard for me sometimes in the heat of these community meetings not to try to, you know, lighten it up a little. When the concern about basketball courts came up, I was this close to saying, "Well, the winners stay on, so all you got to do is win." But I bit my tongue on that one. I've tried. Sometimes when it's getting kind of heated, you know, the humor doesn't go over well. So those are some of life's lessons. There are some studies related to property values and crime. Although, you know, it's hard sometimes showing cause and effect. So what can you do about fear-based opposition? Well, the main thing you can do is try to build relationships and demonstrate your commitment and goodwill. Some of that I just touched on earlier. In meetings, ask opponents to name their concerns and respond to them as quickly as you can. And if concerns amount to discrimination, consider political or legal options. Unfortunately, that's the case sometimes. Let's see, there was something in that that I wanted to add, but I don't think I will. Some other things you can do, educate elected officials, touring affordable housing in the area. That's also an effective strategy. The Fair Housing Act is a very important tool that prevents discrimination from protected classes. And often, discrimination can occur either when it's intentional or when it's not intentional, but it still has a discriminatory impact. The unique thing about farm worker housing is that it's predominantly Latinos. And so there can be a disproportionate impact on that population. And that's often what the opposition can, you know, really at the heart of it be. You know, a lot of times early on and when you go to these community meetings and some of the raw feelings are being expressed, it's quotes like the one I shared earlier, that really are discriminatory. As people get a little more refined, we've had cases, again, this one in Douglas County, where they hired a lawyer to oppose the development, and all of a sudden, instead of being opposed to the people who were going to live there, they were concerned about the environment. They were concerned about our site plan. You know, they were really trying to pick apart the elements of our development. And so the message got much more refined, you know, and technical. And if you just would look on the face of that, you thought, well, this isn't discriminatory. You know, it's just some concerned citizens. Well, those may be some legitimate concerns, and there are some at times. But having been at the earlier meetings before the group hired the lawyer, you know, I got to hear what was really on their minds, and it wasn't the environment. Oops. Let's see. So, we want to educate people about the Fair Housing Act, and typically there can be two responses to that. Either people want to act within the boundaries of the law, or they're worried about the consequences if they don't. And, you know, to be honest, from my perspective, I don't really care if it's one or the other, as long as it's one or the other. I think those are some additional helpful tools. This is, again, another quote from the Pennsylvania study. Government decision makers may not make discriminatory decisions in response to the biases of their constituents. This happens. Just to elaborate quickly on the Douglas County example, that county had actually given us some money to help buy the land that this was going to be built on. And then when they, this neighborhood group got, motivated and involved and actively opposing it. Well, as this headline of the Wenatchee World describes, doing a 180 on migrant housing, they're referring to the county commissioners. Because within our process, after having funded us to help acquire the land, they said, well, we knew you were talking about farm worker housing, but we didn't know you were talking about seasonal housing. And if you look at our application, that's specifically what it says. So anyway, what they did was they did a 180. They said, we no longer support this development. And in fact, the thing that really bothered me most was they claimed that they didn't really understand what we had proposed. I would have personally had a much easier time accepting it if they would have just said, we changed our minds. You know, our constituents are upset, and we changed our minds. But they didn't say that. They said, we didn't understand what you had in mind, which I thought was, you know, basically inaccurate or a lie. Government decision makers, again, may not make discriminatory actions. In this particular case, again, unfortunately, this is the minority of cases. We went through a long legal battle. This one wound up in Superior Court in Douglas County. And fortunately, we were able to succeed and win that case. The development's back underway. We expect it to be done next spring in time for the 2009 growing season, which is great news. But again, not the way we want to do it, very expensive and time consuming. But we feel strongly that at times like this, it's important to try to be that voice of what I believe is justice, fairness, and a more inclusive sense of community. So just a little bit about the Whitworth connection. I've been trying to weave that in throughout my comments, but as I've been thinking a little bit more about my time at Whitworth and how it has affected my life, I really feel like it started out with being a very challenging environment, and including Dr. Soden and Dr. Fraze and many others, Dr. Lee and Dr. Yoder, who were really pushing us to challenge our beliefs and assumptions and question what we believe and why we believe it. And so that was really perfect timing in a young person's life like mine to provide that challenging message. The sense of community, that's a unique element, I think, that's here at Whitworth that I really still miss in a lot of ways, that there is a sense of community here for students and staff and faculty. But it's not just any community. It's really based on our faith and value. And so those values and actions are really motivated by being Christians and saying, okay, I participated in the American Studies program. And is that still offered, Michael? So I spent a semester in Washington, D.C., and there was a professor there who made a very challenging statement during the course of that experience, which was, okay, so you're a Christian. Now what are you going to do about it? And I thought, wow, there's a great summary. There it is. Not just, okay, have you... For me, in my personal faith, I felt like there were many years where the emphasis was on kind of accepting Christ and really kind of making that commitment, which I had done and believe is very important. But no one had put it quite that succinctly of, okay, and now there's more to it. That's not the end. Now you got to do something about it. So that was really, that was one example. There were many more during my time at Whitworth. And fortunately, it's been those type of experiences that when these challenges come up, which quite frankly can be very stressful. I don't enjoy conflict. I don't like facing opposition in Benton City or anywhere else for that matter. I think that's partially why, I was Dr. Soden's student at one time, and now I look like I could be his older brother. I think that's partially because of the stress. I'm not sure. You can look at my dad. Maybe it is genetics. I think there's a lot in common there. But anyway, the real point in all this is that not only the challenges within Whitworth and the community that's established here, but the Christian context of it all, and that not only challenges those beliefs, but then it also gives a framework for building them back up. I'm not one to quote scripture really often, but I saw this recently that I wanted to share, and it's a little long, but I'm sure you can all stick with me. Philippians 2, 1 through 5. If then there is any encouragement in Christ, any consolation from love, any sharing in the Spirit, any compassion and sympathy, make my joy complete. Be of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. Let each of you look not to your own interest, but to the interest of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus. So, that as I was thinking about this and preparing for this, I thought, what a great summary. There it is, in a few verses that really gives us all our challenge. So I thought that was that might be a good one for you. That's a challenge, I think, as students. You know, you want to do your homework and cite your sources when you're doing your coursework, but this is an element of that, you know, that helps provide some of the basis for our values and why we're here. So that's the conclusion of my remarks, and I thank you very much. I think I have a little contact information here, but it doesn't seem to be coming up. Anyway, I'm happy to share. I've got a few business cards and email addresses and whatnot. If anybody would like to be in touch in the future, I would welcome that. Or if there are any questions now, it's about 5 to 8, and I know we have some. There are some other events happening. So Ted, should we, or Michael, should we keep going? Or okay, if there are any questions, anyone would like to ask. Yeah, the question is, what sense do we get from employers about the housing, and how do they feel about it? A lot of times there is some reservations, primarily because they're growers. You know, their business is growing fruit, and housing is a big commitment. You know, it takes active management and maintenance, and it can be a real headache, especially if that's not your primary activity. So that's often the initial reaction is uncertainty and caution. But for the reasons that some of those statistics earlier were citing, housing is becoming a tool for recruitment and retention. And more growers are saying, we want to provide housing so that we can be assured of a good workforce. And my time at ORF, which has been about 15 years, just within the last 5, I've seen a significant increase in the amount of interest and investment by growers. That's a good question. Any other questions?
Marty, is there much response from the religious community in
what you're doing? What direction? It's not a big response, but and it goes, I'm not sure if I mentioned this, you probably understood it over the course of the presentation, but we work around the state. We're based in Yakima, but we work statewide. And the reason I mention that is because there are often groups within communities and churches and religious groups that are very supportive. Michael referred to a development in Manson. The first developments I worked on. That actually started from a small group that was meeting within I think it was the Lutheran Church in Manson. So that's where it was initiated. When we got into the big hubbub in Benton City that I was talking about earlier, there was a Methodist church that was very active. And in fact, the pastor of that Methodist church really felt strongly about it and contacted the Association of Washington Churches. They sent their executive director over for a couple of these public meetings, and which was great. Very articulate person, you know, who spoke in favor of the developments, even in these hostile crowds. So it's been a little mixed, but there's been some excellent examples of where there can be a very positive contribution. Yeah, good question, and it's good to see you too. the question was, what kind of thought do we put into the units themselves and the construction? You know, overall, we serve families, so we want to, you know, in a generic sense, we want to build adequate number of bedrooms so that people aren't overcrowded. In the last probably 3 or 4 years, we've increasingly focused on green building techniques. Energy efficiency, has not only environmental benefits, but it reduces the cost. It makes rents more affordable. So we've done some really interesting things recently with products like there's a product called structurally insulated panels, which are prefabricated in a warehouse and are highly energy efficient and better insulation values. New and better windows, different types of heating methods, the list goes on and on. But that's something that's really still evolving, and kind of an exciting part of what we're doing is how do we become more energy efficient and have a lesser impact on our environment. Yeah, that is another great question. The question was the percentage of undocumented workers, and do they have equal access? A lot of times in farm worker housing and the farm worker world, that's kind of the 800-pound elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. Statistics for farm workers are really hard to come by because they move around a lot. There's a lot of fear and suspicion about legal status. But the best estimates that we have are anywhere from 50 to 70% of the farm worker population are not documented, which is a big, big problem. And that's where actually growers and the industry is also conflicted. Because a lot of times there can be more, conservative political tendencies, which make them feel like, immigration is an issue that they feel strongly about and not wanting to have illegal immigrants. On the other hand, they acknowledge that this is their workforce. There are some real tense points of discussion within the employer, the ag industry. Access to housing, that can really depend on the financing. Some financing requires that those who sign the lease demonstrate or provide documentation. And when that's the case, people don't want to apply. Sometimes it's because they're undocumented. Sometimes it's because they may have a family member who's undocumented and they don't want to put them at risk. So fear can, unfortunately, have a major impact. There are other types of financing where you're not required to ask for legal status documentation. In fact, that's most often the case for any of us, when we want to get housing. It's rare we have to document our legal status. We have to document our income and things like that, our ability to pay. But so, yes, it can inhibit it, and that is a significant problem within the agricultural world. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, the question was, do we work when we're doing a housing development with other service providers like English as a second language or a variety of social services? Absolutely. And in fact, actually getting back to one of Dr. Soden's points too, we've been working more lately with Catholic Charities Housing Services in Yakima. They provide a great deal of housing. They also have what they refer to as the Ministry of Management, where they really feel like active management is a core part of their values, motivated by their Christian faith. And so a major part of that is service provision. And, they build community rooms on their developments. We work with them a lot on that, where they can do English as a second language or parenting classes or financial literacy. There's a whole slew of things that can be done, and we really try hard to incorporate those into our housing work. Yes. Oh, yeah. The question or statement was talk a little bit about a Granger Community Service Center that we're really excited. We kind of took this foray in outside of housing to build a community service facility in Granger, Washington, which is a very small town and typically one of the two or three poorest towns in the state of Washington. It houses Radio KDNA, or Radio Cadena, which is the first Spanish-language public radio station in the country. And they, so as Amy was saying, this is a major element of outreach and service. They do all sorts of stuff like immigrant rights and, again, some of the service concepts that we were just talking about. It's a great new, they were in this dilapidated 100-year-old structure that had mold in the basement and was structurally falling apart and was just in real bad shape. We just got through building a brand new facility, state of the art, which they just moved into a few months ago. It's really a gem in the city of Granger. They're very happy. In fact, I got to go to the, gubernatorial debate last night in Yakima, and coincidentally I ran into the executive director of Radio Cadena, and she was telling me that they're already running out of space. The response has been really positive. Not only is the radio station there, but a number of other service providers. And so it's a good problem to have, but another good, excellent outreach tool to the Spanish-speaking population and farm workers in particular. Okay, well, I thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back, and I appreciate you all being here.